From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And as members of Congress leave Washington for the 4th of July recess, Senate Republicans have yet to agree on a bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. On Twitter this morning, President Trump wrote, "If Republican senators are unable to pass what they're working on now, they should immediately repeal and then replace at a later date." That tweet from the president, not the one getting all the attention this week. We'll get to that.
Yes, we will. Joining us, Juana Summers, senior writer for CNN Politics. Hi, Juana.
Hey, guys.
And Ron Elving, senior Washington editor and correspondent at NPR. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
And Ron, let's start with the president's tweet today about health care reform. He tweeted about immediately repealing. This was right after Senator Ben Sasse made somewhat the same comment on Fox and Friends. He was talking about repealing parts of Obamacare. But the president said immediately repeal the whole thing. And someone tweeted back at him on Twitter, "Why should the American people suffer because you and your party are unable to come up with a plan?" So what is going on? Because it is thought if there's immediate repeal, people won't be covered.
Well, there will be a period of time before the immediate repeal would actually be immediate, before it would actually take effect. They would create some kind of a buffer zone of months, perhaps a year. And so Obamacare would, of course, remain in place after having been repealed in effect until that date had arrived. Now, what has happened at this point is mostly the leadership has thrown up its hands in exasperation because this was their original plan. Their original plan was to immediately repeal Obamacare back in January and then have a period of time for implementation and come up with some kind of a replacement in those months. Now, all of this time has been spent futilely coming up with a bill that passed in the House largely on the promise that the Senate could fix it, and now the Senate can't come up with anything at all. So they're all the way back to square one at a time when it's much less feasible because we're deep into the year and the rules are going to change as we get into the fall. It's going to be that much more difficult to pass it with a simple majority in the Senate.
Well, Ben Sasse tweeted back to President Trump, "Yes, let's do that. And let's get rid of summer recess in August, work 6 days a week to write a replacement." Is he serious?
He is serious. I think he would do it. I think he would give up his August and he would work 6 days a week and he would be glad to have an up or down showdown vote on Labor Day. But how many other senators and members of the House are able or willing to make that same commitment? And where's the guarantee that even under those draconian conditions, they could actually come up with the agreement that's eluded them so far?
Well, and the bill that we're talking about right now that they presented and that they got a Congressional Budget Office score on would leave, according to the CBO, 22 million people uninsured. Let's listen to President Trump at the White House on Wednesday.
"So we're working very hard on health care, and I think we're going to have a great answer, and hopefully we're going to have it soon. And we will keep you informed. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there any concern about the Medicaid cuts in the health care bill?
It's going to be great. This will be great for everybody."
He says it's going to be great for everybody. We spoke with Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas, where they did expand Medicaid under Obamacare. He's got real concerns about how many people would lose coverage. Juana, what happens now with the Senate bill?
I think that what we've seen from the president today has really caused a lot more confusion about what will actually happen. Senators have come back to the drawing board. Obviously, they're not in Washington today. They've gone home for the holiday recess. I want to turn back to one thing that Ron said. I think that Senator Sasse certainly may be willing to stay in August. The other issue is with what the president has proposed and just repealing now, replacing later. That is hugely unpopular among Republicans. CNN did a survey back in March, and less than 20% of Americans said they favored repealing parts of the bill without a replacement on the table. I think that makes a very delicate political environment that these senators and lawmakers head back to their districts and face, and it makes the pressure just even more ratcheted up on them to figure this out and to come up with something palatable for people who do fear losing that coverage.
Well, an NPR had a poll out this week that shows just 17% of Americans favor the Republican bill.
That's right. And there are even worse polls for the Senate bill. The USA Today Suffolk University poll had the approval down at 12%. The problem for Republicans is that the 12% of a 17%, whatever it is, those people are all Republican primary voters, and they really expect that repeal to be done. That was a promise made to them for the last 7 years.
Okay, well, then there was the matter of yesterday. And the Mika Joe tweet, look, this is Donald Trump's really stunning tweet that came out early in the morning attacking Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough, co-hosts, fiancés of Morning Joe on MSNBC. Apparently, she had said something about how his tweets reveal, you know, his dark underbelly. And he came out with that tweet attacking her, saying they both begged to be with him at Mar-a-Lago. And he said no because her face was bleeding from a facelift. As we heard, and we'll hear again right now, reaction came in from both sides of the aisle. Here's House Speaker Ryan O'Neill calling the tweets inappropriate.
Look, what we're trying to do around here is improve the tone and the civility of the debate. And this obviously doesn't help do that.
And how do you...
I leapt back in time there. I think I called him Ryan O'Neill, House Speaker Paul Ryan. And here's Texas Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee. She said Trump should resign.
The people seek not to have kings or queens, but they seek to have an office of the presidency that can be trusted. Today, Mr. Trump, you have ceased to have the trust of the American people.
Look, I want to jump in here. People are saying there was just, you know, from both sides of the aisle. But some people are saying not enough from at least one side of the aisle, the Republican side. How do you think this is playing out?
Well, first of all, I have to say that while I think the comments are reprehensible and inappropriate, they didn't really surprise me. We've heard President Trump, when he was candidate Trump, speak about women's appearances. It was Megyn Kelly and the blood coming out of wherever. It was Carly Fiorina and look at that face. This is language we're used to. But I do think that among some Republicans, we're hearing Maine Senator Susan Collins being one of them, that there is a question as to whether or not Trump is damaging not just his presidency, but demeaning the office which he holds and sending bad signals to those around the country and around the world about what the American presidency means. And furthermore, this is a moment where he is using the bully pulpit to make commentary about a media host's appearance rather than using it to champion his legislative agenda. And I wonder if there are folks in the White House who are hoping to kind of right the ship and encourage him to maybe focus on the health care bill that we were just talking about, as opposed to maybe Mika Brzezinski's face and what it looks like or doesn't look like.
Well, Ron, there was also the Access Hollywood tape, which shocked everyone, but then didn't stop him from winning the presidency. There's sort of a question here about how shocked we should be by something that, as Juana said, doesn't seem shocking anymore, but at the same time, it's very different from anything we've seen from any president in the past.
Yes, in fact, that is the point. He is no longer a candidate for president. He is no longer the host of The Apprentice, as he was back when that Access Hollywood tape was made in 2005. He is now the president of the United States. And many people make the case for him saying, look, you've got to respect the office. Even if you don't like the man, you must respect the office and the executive authority of the United States, the majesty, if you will, of the office and of the entire United States. You have to reposit that in one man during these 4 years. And all people are saying, and this is Republicans as well as Democrats, all they're saying is, please, Mr. President, you should respect the dignity of that office at least that much.
Look, both Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough came back today. They wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post. They talked about, first of all, how they said Trump was lying in how he had told the story that they didn't beg to be at Mar-a-Lago, that she didn't have a facelift. She had a little something under her chin, which got a lot of us thinking, wait, what can you do on your chin? But, you know, it became very serious because the headline was they feel that he is off balance. The question I have is how far does he go, Ron? I mean, how much can a president say? And again, there's no precedent for this that I can think of. How much can a president do a personal attack before what? Before we just get so used to it that it doesn't matter anymore, or it somehow stops because of his own party asking him? What do you think happens here?
Probably the only people who can really make an impact, who can really make a difference in how he goes forward in his behavior, are his immediate family, his daughter Ivanka, his wife, his other children. The people that he holds dearest must step up to make the difference if anyone is going to be able to. Perhaps they have tried. Perhaps they have tried desperately to do exactly that. But up to now, it hasn't been effective, and it's hard to see how anyone else's opinion is going to matter to him.
Juana, we have time probably for one more topic here, and I want to get to it here. Voter fraud, the commission to investigate voter fraud. President Trump, as we know, made some unsubstantiated claims that millions of people voted illegally in November. The Kansas Secretary of State, Kris Kobach, who's a Republican and vice chair of the commission, sent a request this week to state election officials that they send all publicly available voter data to the commission before they meet in July. State officials are pushing back. What's going on here?
They are. So what Kris Kobach from Kansas is asking for is the so-called available voter roll data. So we're talking about full names of registered voters, their date of birth, party registration, last four digits of Social Security numbers. And a number of people, including Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, say that that could risk the integrity of the vote there. Mm-hmm. It could mean a sweeping change to the voting system. And they're concerned that this could, in fact, that there's no significant voter fraud. And this is essentially in search of a problem that's not actually there. I expect we'll hear a lot from civil rights groups coming up in the near future, too, who are likely to express alarm at this as well.
Okay. That's Juana Summers, senior writer for CNN Politics. Ron Elving, senior Washington editor and correspondent at NPR. Thank you both. And we wish you both a happy 4th of July weekend.
Happy 4th.
Yeah. You too.
Happy 4th.
We love food festivals, seeing how many different things you can fry on a stick and how many festivals there are. There's the National Lentil Festival in Pullman, Washington, the Gilroy Garlic Festival, Gilroy, California. We're going to check in all summer, but we start in McLeod, Oklahoma, where today the McLeod Blackberry Festival kicks off. There'll be an evening gown competition tonight, tomorrow a parade, a blackberry baking contest, a cobbler gobbler, that's the eating competition you must have. It's all been around since the 1940s when there was a booming commercial blackberry industry in town. But most of the blackberry farms have closed. The blackberries are now mostly brought in. But McLeodians are undeterred. Glenda Kuhn is president of the McLeod Historical Society. She joins us now from KOSU in nearby Oklahoma City. And Glenda, we understand that even the few local blackberries left won't be there at the festival because they ripened early this year. So that's been a bit of a problem.
Yes, and even some of our wild blackberries that grow prolifically in the area are not doing as well this year because of weather-related problems.
Yeah, well, that's happening. There are people who have, food festivals around items that, you know, nobody remembers having grown. But you do. Take us back.
I do.
Yeah.
Well, my stepdad raised blackberries on Chambliss Farms, and so we picked blackberries every summer. That was just what all the kids in school did. We made our summer money for fireworks or to go to Spring Lake Park, the amusement park, or the zoo, whatever, by picking blackberries for 3 to 5 cents a quart.
Oh, just 3 to 5 cents. I could just picture kids, you know, presenting their quarts with half of the blackberries on their face.
yes.
and this has been traditionally a farming community, right? Cotton, potatoes.
It has been. It started out with cotton early on, and then it was potatoes, and then it became blackberries, and now it's wheat and feed crops for animals and things like that.
Yeah. But we do understand in the 60s, there was trouble with the blackberry industry. Wages were rising, and blackberry growers couldn't pay workers to keep up. And then an idea came of getting a subsidy. So what happened?
The Blackberry Association president at the time, his name was Isaac Wallace, decided that the farmers could possibly get subsidies for their blackberries. So they decided to do this media attention-getting project, mm-hmm. and they took the blackberries out to the North Canadian River, called in the Daily Oklahoman, the mm-hmm. Shawnee News Star, the area newspapers, and dumped the blackberries in the river. There were no subsidies. There were not that much media. And so many of the blackberry farmers at that time began to plow up their blackberries and put in crops that they could actually make a living with.
Oh, so there was this attempt to, you know, almost like a tea party. You know, we're going to dump the blackberries if somebody doesn't help us. But the subsidies didn't come?
No.
Well, what happened to the Blackberry Festival after that?
It continued for a long time just because it was tradition. There had been a July the 4th celebration from the day the first train came through McLeod, July the 4th, 1895. And it just changed its name to the Blackberry Festival during the 3 decades that it was the blackberry capital of the world.
Really? You were the blackberry capital of the world?
Oh, yes. More blackberries were raised in and around McLeod, and they were brought to McLeod as a central location where they were packed, labeled, and shipped to Oklahoma City Farmer Market.
Now, this is kind of sad, you know, that, but you still celebrate that past with the festival. And you know, the other things happen. We understand. We see it in a lot of small towns. An interstate came in that made it easier for people to, you know, go around the downtown, go to stores further away, grocery stores, cafes began to close. But we understand you have some new employers in recent years. It's added some life to the town.
Oh, yes. We have the Citizen Band Potawatomi built the Grand Casino, which is just south of town, and the Kickapoo tribe built a casino about 4 miles north of town. And then we had a private prison, women's prison, that bought near McLeod, and they are now the only state women's prison in Oklahoma.
Huh. Well, and I'm thinking of the Native American, the casinos and the culture centers, which we understand are really bringing life back to a lot of small towns.
Oh, yes. Many of them have medical facilities. They have a lot more things besides the casinos. So they're really kind of a community all to themselves.
We recently visited the Chickasaw Cultural Center. It was amazing. Well, so back to the Blackberry Festival.
Uh-huh.
You know, since you're no longer, I'm sorry to say, the Blackberry capital of the world, why still have the festival?
It's just a way for people to come together and remember, and it was our one claim to fame, and we just want to keep it alive.
Okay, so tell me. I mean, I've been salivating. Blackberries, they're so good. What are some of the recipes? What are some things that people there did or still do with blackberries? Because they're still grown there. You know, what's the best way to have blackberries?
I like blackberry ice cream or vanilla ice cream with blackberries on top. Mm. But we also have, of course, variations of the famous blackberry cobblers, and we have a blackberry cobbler contest each year. I had a call yesterday wanting a historical recipe for blackberry wine cake.
And what is that? What are the key ingredients? I mean, blackberries, obviously, and wine?
Well, you make a vanilla cake and pretty much use the liquid is blackberry wine, and then you make a blackberry wine and powdered sugar glaze on top, and it's luscious.
Oh, yes, it must be. Glenda Kuhn, president of the McLeod Historical Society, their Blackberry Festival kicks off today. Glenda, have a wonderful time.
Thank you. We will.
And if you're not lucky enough to go to McLeod's Blackberry Festival this weekend, there's the Key Lime Pie Festival in Key West, Florida, the National Cherry Festival in Traverse City, Michigan, the Windy City Rib Fest in Chicago, not to be confused with the Naperville Rib Fest in Naperville, Illinois. Let us know what your town plans this summer at hereandnow.org. Somewhere, there has got to be a hot dog fest. But let's talk hot dogs for a second. They're processed. They're pretty much lacking in nutrition. So if you eat meat, should you eat them? Alana Gordon of Here and Now contributor WHYY's The Pulse went shopping with a nutritionist.
We begin this story where most barbecues begin.
Someone to the front of the bar for customer assistance, please.
At the grocery store.
We're going to stop at the special item of the week, the hot dog.
That's Nairi Dardarian. She's a registered dietitian who teaches nutrition at Drexel University. She's hosting a barbecue, and I've asked to tag along as she shops.
I've never seen this before. It's a hot dog station.
She reaches into a refrigerator bin and grabs a package of hot dogs.
And I'm going to take a look at the label.
First, she looks at calories.
And I'm looking at this 160 calories for the whole hot dog.
Then fat.
120 of those calories come from fat.
What's your reaction to that?
That's a lot of fat. I don't really want to eat fat on a bun.
The last thing she looks at is sodium content.
Kind of a rule of thumb is don't go over 300 milligrams of sodium for one serving of any type of food.
Too much salt can lead to high blood pressure, heart disease, and stroke. This one has 480 milligrams.
I guess we're going to make a decision here.
She grabs a few different kinds, including some veggie, turkey, lean, and low-sodium options, and heads out.
Okay, so the lettuce looks good. Nice and chopped.
It's the next day, and Nairi Dardarian is prepping in the kitchen. The hot dogs are out, but she's also making an Armenian-style salad. It's a combination of cracked wheat, tomato, parsley, and olive oil.
Then you don't feel as guilty if you balance your hot dog out with a side that's full of really good whole grains and lettuce, tomatoes.
For Dardarian, it's all about padding an occasional hot dog with nutritional sides, not a bag of chips or a second hot dog. She heads outside for the next step.
Okay, grill is lit. Let this heat up.
Studies have shown that cooking at high temperatures, like on a grill, is associated with colon, pancreatic, and prostate cancers. There's some evidence that marinating meats could reduce that risk. Still, Dardarian says we've been grilling for millennia. The key is, don't do it all the time. Dardarian's guests arrive.
My name is Leah Joy.
My name is Ben Graff.
Danny Talenti.
My name is Jessica Lynn.
Back outside.
So we're just putting these on the grill.
Dardarian lays out several options.
Your authentic ballpark hot dog. Then we have a spin on that.
A lean one, less calories but still high in fat. And there's a veggie one. It's low in fat but still has a lot of sodium.
Are any of these, like, better or worse?
I would say no. They are all on the same scale of hot dog.
Some hot dogs at health food stores advertise being lower in fat, organic, with fewer or no additives. For Dardarian, it's still a hot dog, so there's trade-offs.
All right, who's going to dig into the hot dog bar?
Ben Graff pretty much inhales an authentic ballpark hot dog. He's not too worried about its lack of nutrition.
Yeah, I'm not going to eat a hot dog all the time, but if I'm going to have one, I'm just going to go for it.
I'm vegetarian, so I grab a veggie dog.
What do you think?
The ketchup and onions help the taste.
This is getting better.
But still, not so great.
Okay, here I go.
Dardarian decides to give the low-fat, low-sodium white turkey hot dog a try. She looks disappointed.
It's not nearly as spicy as a regular hot dog.
She says next time she'll opt for a regular one. But that next time, it's not going to be for a while.
I think I just take a hot dog for what it is. It's a hot dog.
To be eaten rarely, like, say, on the 4th of July.
Hot dog cheers!
That is an awesome word there that he just said.
For Here and Now, I'm Alana Gordon.
New York City subways seem to have hit a crisis point this week after the train derailment that injured dozens and brought even more attention to the city's aging transportation system. Yesterday, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo declared a state of emergency and pledged $1 billion for improvements.
We need ideas outside the box because, frankly, the box is broken. Standard practices have failed us. We need a new approach, a new culture, new methods to quickly and dramatically make progress.
Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And first of all, it's hard to overstate how reliant New Yorkers are on the MTA, but give us a picture of how much use the system gets.
Well, big picture, I think it's a good time to be based in Boston like you guys. I don't know if you have a spare desk up there for me, but you're right. It's an incredibly essential part of the infrastructure of New York. Ridership is about 5.7 million a day and almost 1.8 billion rides per year as of 2016. And that's up by more than 100 million over the past 5 years annually. And I think the one thing that people outside of New York may not realize is that even if you can afford a car in Manhattan or afford to take a cab or even a limo wherever you want to go, you often find yourself on the subway because it's the fastest way to get anywhere. So this pain of the subway problems is really shared across the board.
And for the record, our subway system is even older than yours in New York, so it's got some problems too. But what kind of maintenance is needed at this point on the New York subway system?
Well, part of the New York subway are more than 100 years old. There are some cars that are more than 50 years old. And what really exacerbated the problems was Hurricane Sandy in 2012, when many stations and tracks were flooded. And that caused corrosion in a lot of the electrical systems. The New York Times today pointed out that the signal system in parts of the subway date back to the 1930s. And without a modern signal system, the subway can't really add more trains to accommodate this surge in ridership that they've had.
So is $1 billion from the governor going to make the difference? I mean, this is in addition to a $32 billion improvement plan that's already in place.
Right. So that $32 billion also it includes projects throughout the Metropolitan Transportation Authority's purview. So that means money for things like bridges and tunnels and the commuter trains that go out to Long Island. So this additional $1 billion is going to be focused just on the subways. And, you know, it's arguable that it'll be enough to really fix all the problems.
Now, meanwhile, one of the places that people who don't live in New York often see when they go to New York is Penn Station, which sees 600,000 people every day. It's where the Amtrak trains come in and a lot of the commuter trains come in. Bloomberg has a story out about the problems there, which is its own set of issues.
Right. New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo is calling this the summer of hell for all the problems we're going to be dealing with. Mainly from about the middle of July to the beginning of September, Amtrak, which operates Penn Station, is going to be replacing some of the tracks there. And that will affect not just Amtrak trains, but New Jersey Transit trains that I ride and the Long Island Railroad. So it is really setting up to be a big mess this summer. And again, it's the same story. It's antiquated infrastructure. And again, Hurricane Sandy wreaked havoc on this system, too. And it's never quite recovered completely from it.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And now to a segment we tried to bring you a few weeks ago, but couldn't because of breaking news. It's a Texas edition of the DJ Sessions.
Up still not dead again today.
Joe Nick Petoskey hosts the Texas Music Hour of Power at Marfa Public Radio in Marfa, Texas, which is about 60 miles from the border with Mexico. Joe Nick, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. And you play a lot of different styles on your show, but all out of Texas. Tell us about some of them before we hear them.
Well, Texas is a mishmash of a lot of sounds, and it has a lot of different indigenous musics. You know, the basic food groups of American music, country, and blues, Texans kind of have ownership of both those sounds. And then there's all kinds of other sounds running around like Western swing, jazz, country, original music. You know, there's things like zydeco and conjunto and tejano. There's all kinds of musics, and part of the goal of this show is to play all the Texas musics we got.
All right, well, let's get to some of it. And first, you wanted us to hear from someone who has been at this for a while. This is Delbert McClinton featuring Jimmy Vaughn and Lou Ann Barton with Don't Do It.
We were all down at South Street when the bottle fell out. Somebody screamed, "What you talking about?" I heard a glass break and somebody moan. Saw Raymond running out the front door, screaming into his cell phone. Don't do it. There must be something I can do. Please don't do it. Let me make it up to you. We've been together so long. Baby, please hold on. Don't do it.
So how would you describe this?
Well, it depends how you want to describe it. Delbert's been described as country. That's definitely rhythm and blues and a lot of that, what we call Texas shuffle. It's got a swing to it. And, of course, Jimmy Vaughn is the older brother of Stevie Vaughn. He's one of the great interpreters of modern American blues music. So blues, rock and roll, this is a guy that taught harmonica to John Lennon of the Beatles before the Beatles became the Beatles. He's been around, so it's Texas music. That's what we call it.
He's 76 years old, Delbert McClinton.
Yeah, and he's still, you know, he's got some chops. That's brand new music from his latest album.
All right, well, next you wanted us to hear from the Austin group Shiny Ribs. This is called Trouble Trouble.
Yeah, when the devil come a call, don't you answer that door no more. He lay with a banker and a family, break up our show.
Hey, the trouble with friends, the trouble with friends.
So on Twitter, this group refers to itself, and by the way, this would sound so much better if you were saying it than me, but here we go. The Baryshnikov of the Big Thicket, the Pavarotti of the Piney Woods, the Redneck Parliament, Walt Whitman of Thumb Wrestling, the Bruce Lee of ukulele.
That's Kevin Russell in a nutshell. He comes from the southeast corner of Texas called the Golden Triangle, where so much great music like George Jones, Johnny Winter, Janis Joplin, people like that came out of that corner of the state, and, you know, that's, to me, Texas music once again. What you want to call it, well, depends how you describe things.
Well, and how would you describe this style of music?
Well, I think it's definitely roots music, and a lot of people pigeonhole it as Americana. And if you want to talk Americana, I make the argument that all started in Austin in the early 70s when Willie Nelson, Doug Somm, folks like Willis Allen Ramsey, Jerry Jeff Walker, all and Sleep at the Wheel are all moving to town and mixing up traditional sounds and basically making it new.
Okay, well, the next selection from you is Down in the Barrio by Los Tex Maniacs with Alejandro Escovedo.
Way down in the barrio, something that we all know. The bullets are flying and people are dying for reasons they don't even know.
Down in the barrio, down in the barrio.
Okay, let's talk about that accordion first.
Yeah, that's Josh Baca. And accordion's a big deal in Texas, and especially in Tejano and Conjunto music, what we call Tex-Mex. And it's usually elders that are recognized, like the great Flaco Jimenez or Esteban Jordan, the Jimi Hendrix of accordion. But this generation's great accordionist is Josh Baca. I've got my eyes on him. He is a hot player, and I'm looking forward to seeing where he's going to take this Tex-Mex sound.
And do you hear a lot of the Tex-Mex sound where you are in Marfa, which, as we said, is not too far from the Mexican border?
Well, you've got to understand the Tri-County area, which is as big as Connecticut, 10,000 people. They call it the Trans-Pecos Big Bend. It's bicultural, and it's bilingual. I mean, it really is. It's in the air, so on my show, there's a lot of Freddie Fender, the great classics like Lydia Mendoza, Narciso Martinez, Isidro Lopez. Well, actually, one of my favorites is Piñata Protest, which are the Ramones of Conjunto polka music. So I know it sounds strange, but you got to hear it, and it sounds actually kind of natural.
All right, well, you wanted us to hear from a group out of Crosby, Texas, originally from Louisiana. This is Jerome Baptiste and the Zydeco Players with Creole Country Boy, Volume 1.
I'm a callin' for fun, but I'm a shooter dough this time, y'all. That's the way we do it in the Creole world. Take care of y'all. We just a Creole Country Boy. We just a Creole Country Boy. We just a Creole Country Boy.
So I remember going to a Zydeco show years ago in Maryland with a friend who is just a huge Zydeco fan. How big is it in Texas?
Well, on a given Saturday night, there's more Zydeco being played in Houston than anywhere.
Hmm.
I mean, it's associated with Southwest Louisiana, which is really where it came from, rural Louisiana. But the Creole migration to Houston, you got to look at Houston in that context as being L.A., the promised land. So there are loads of Zydeco bands and contemporary bands, some that are mixing hip-hop in instead of rhythm and blues or country sounds. Little Brian is Zydeco Travelers, Jabbo, Step Rito, Leroy Thomas, and all these groups are led by an accordion, but they often sing in French. And like I said, Houston is probably the epicenter of Zydeco music today.
All right, well, we have time for one more, and you wanted us to hear a song that everyone will recognize, although probably not this version. Let's listen. Now, this is someone that you mentioned, Flaco Jimenez and Buck Owens.
Right, and it's kind of a way of demonstrating that Texans don't observe borders or boundaries or color lines when it comes to music. You've got Buck Owens, who is the creator of the Bakersfield sound in Southern California, but he came out of Sherman, Texas, up by the Oklahoma line. And then Flaco Jimenez is really the great exporter of the Tex-Mex accordion discovery of Doug Somm. He's played with everyone from Bob Dylan to the Rolling Stones. He's out of San Antonio, and what better song to kind of collaborate on but a Beatles song? And that is the least Beatles-sounding Beatles song.
Absolutely.
That you've heard in at least the last 24 hours. Right. I would challenge you on that one. But that's Texas. And forget who we are, you know, in the political realm or whatever. Culturally, we're just a wonderful mishmash. And that's why I love Texas music. And we've got a great recorded body of work that goes back to the 1920s. But it's here and now, and it's happening.
And your favorite city in Texas is?
Marfa, Texas.
Of course, right where you are. Joe Nick Potosky hosts the Texas Music Hour of Power at Marfa Public Radio in Marfa, Texas. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Jeremy. And remember, salvation through Texas music.
And you can join the thousands of people following our Spotify playlist. Just search for NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org. Love
me. Today, Germany's parliament voted to legalize same-sex marriage, bringing the country in line with many other EU countries. Chancellor Angela Merkel voted against the measure, but the vote itself was able to take place because she dropped her opposition to it, saying she'd had a life-changing experience. The BBC's Jenny Hill is in Berlin. Jenny, Merkel talked about that experience at the beginning of the week in a live stage conversation with Bridget magazine. What did she say?
Yeah, Angela Merkel's change of heart, if you will, rather took Germany by surprise. She has, for a very long time, been very much opposed to same-sex marriage. Her concerns, were led to believe, centred around the welfare of children who might be adopted by married same-sex couples. And that's why, despite efforts for a number of years now by the political left in Germany to bring this kind of legislation to the parliament, it's never been able to actually come to fruition. So out of the blue earlier this week, Angela Merkel, during an interview, she's gearing up for her election campaign here, the general election is in the autumn, gave an interview during which she talked about this life-changing experience. She met, she said, a lesbian couple in her own constituency in the north of Germany who had fostered 8 children. And Angela Merkel appears to have been so impressed by the loving family home that the couple had set up that she appears to have had a real change of heart. But crucially, saying that from now on, she would allow MPs in her own party to vote on the issue according to their conscience. They wouldn't have to follow the party line. And that meant that the political left, her opposition, jumped straight in at the first opportunity, got this bill to Parliament. Today is the last chance before Parliament breaks up, actually, for the summer recess. So very much at the last minute, because they knew that there was sufficient support within the Conservative Party to pass the bill. And that, of course, is what's happened.
Well, she wouldn't be the first world leader to change her mind on gay marriage. Barack Obama famously did. Hillary Clinton did. But was there also some, you know, politics here? What's public opinion on gay marriage?
Well, this again is very interesting. Actually, the majority of opinion polls show that Germans really favour same-sex marriage legislation. There is a feeling here that Germany's very much lagged behind other Western democracies on this particular issue. But you talk about politics. You know, Angela Merkel has got her eye on that general election. And as you said earlier, she voted against the bill this morning. And I think that's for a number of reasons. First of all, afterwards, she said, you know, for her, it's a personal conviction. Marriage, she believes, in law, is something which takes place between a man and a woman. That's her personal conviction. But I think, secondly, she's bearing in mind that, you know, she's voted against the bill, but she is still going to go down in the history books as the chancellor who introduced same-sex marriage to Germany. So she's voted against the bill to appeal to the more conservative of her electorate. She's also allowed that vote to happen in the first place, knowing full well what the result was very likely to be, because she she wanted to appease potential future coalition partners. She's looking potentially, if she wins a majority in September, to form coalitions with a couple of parties who've made it clear that they want same-sex marriage legislation as a condition of that kind of partnership. And, of course, she's keen to cement that growing reputation she has as the West's last defender of liberal values.
Well, tell us more about that, the leading voice in acceptance of refugees. Tell us more about how she's emerging in that way.
Actually, I think it's largely in response to the new Donald Trump administration. Angela Merkel has always been a popular figure when you look at her approval ratings. Now, they did slump during the refugee crisis when Germans, having been pretty tolerant at first, started to fear that perhaps she'd open the doors to rather too many asylum seekers. But those figures have very much been steadily recovering since Donald Trump came to power. Actually, there is a sense here that Angela Merkel is profiting. In a world where many see instability emanating from the Trump administration, Angela Merkel is really emerging as not just the de facto leader of Europe, which is a role she's often had, but really as sort of a strong and stable leader within the world. Pew Research released a survey a week or so back, which found that actually globally, she's really seen as a very strong figure now. But, you know, bear in mind, she has this reputation as a pastor, a vicar's daughter, as somebody who grew up behind the division within Germany, as someone who has always defended liberal values, who talks a lot about liberal values. So I think that the subject of same-sex marriage would have come back to haunt her, and probably quite soon, because as I say, she's going to be looking for coalition partners. And the two main parties in her sight had made it very clear that this was an issue upon which they would want to do business. I think also perhaps the electorate would have started to look at her and think, well, come on, if you're going to sort of talk about how we've all got to express these common shared values, you know, she said the same, I think, to Donald Trump when he first took office. If you're going to stand by that kind of expression, you're going to have to put your money where your mouth is and perhaps go a bit further when it comes to equality.
The BBC's Jenny Hill in Berlin, where the German parliament has recognized same-sex marriage. Jenny, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
And this note, later today on All Things Considered, the deadly war on drugs in the Philippines, some 7,000 people believed to have been killed. That's later today, ATC. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.